available. Start, we're a couple of minutes late. House Revenue Committee, and today is June the 2nd, about 1:32, and we'll go ahead. We'll take these just a little bit out of order today. We'll start with House Bill 2787. Let's see. Elizabeth, you have 2787. Can you give us an update, please?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2787, you have a -7 amendment there in your packet. So I'll just go through that. And what it is doing is adds the volunteer certified EMTs who have at least 20% of their total emergency medical technical services as a volunteer in rural areas to the group of medical providers who are eligible for a personal income tax credit. So this is a portion of the amendments that we were talking about earlier with this bill. So this is taking that exact same language, and then it provides a new definition for rural. So it's, again, discussing things that we had talked about before, with the rural area being now defined as at least 25 miles from any city with a population of 30,000 or more for this new EMT personal income tax credit. And it restricts that EMT tax credit to just $250. So this is not the same as the rural medical provider tax credit, which goes up to $5,000. Okay, this is just $250. And it applies to tax credit certifications made by the Office of Rural Health beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. And it allows the Office of Rural Health Rulemaking Authority to establish criteria for certifying individuals as eligible for this tax credit. Now, another important part of this amendment is it does have in there then a requirement that the Office of Rural Health provide a report no later than October 1st, 2006 to the House and Senate Interim Committees on Revenue. And then it outlines the issues that are needed to be addressed in the report. And basically, a lot of the issues that are outlined in the report are things that we had already discussed in that last amendment. It's dealing with requiring the impact on health care and revenue from the addition of new types of medical providers in the rural areas. If you have different providers allowed the rural medical provider tax credit. Then it also wants an analysis on the means testing for this rural medical provider tax credit. And it also wants an impact from changing the definition of rural to a new definition specified in this act, meaning the 25 miles or more from any population of 30,000 or more. Then it also would have an impact then and of a new definition for frontier, which we had been discussing in prior discussions with this bill. As a county with population density of 19 or fewer people per square mile. And also an analysis of just the condition of the medical, mental, nursing, and pharmacy services in rural and frontier areas. So it gives quite a bit of distinct direction to the Office of Rural Health in the interim for the report that they'll have to prepare. So basically with this amendment, as far as the revenue impact, I did not have yet the actual numbers of EMTs in this new definition of rural area. So just so everyone's clear, what I had was for a frontier, and that was the larger definition of frontier of 19 or fewer people per square mile. So I had a beginning point of 774, and I just asked the Office of Rural Health after I saw this amendment to give me some new numbers as far as EMT. So that still is something that is in flux, but it shouldn't change significantly from these numbers, but it just may go up. So I may make changes in the next day or two if the Office of Rural Health can get me some new numbers for EMTs. So basically with right now, with the information we have, there's like 774 EMTs that are working in rural areas, and then when you give them a $250 credit, and assuming that there's about 10% of them who wouldn't be able to take the full amount of that credit given their tax liability in a given year. In 2005-07 biennium, that would be $260,654, and then for a full biennium, because this is just beginning in January 1st, 2006, in a full biennium of 2007-09 biennium, it would be roughly $390,310. And then by 09-11, $414,398. So again, this is kind of a preliminary revenue impact, but it wouldn't change much from this once I get some additional information from the Office of Rural Health with this new definition of rural.
Great. Colleagues, we had sent the folks from Rural Health back two or three times to make sure that we made sure that what we were looking at were those volunteers that were spending at least 20% of their total time in emergency medical technician services as volunteers, that the that we made a new definition for rural, as well as a report from the office on several issues, and you'll see those on in section five. And if there's no, first of all, what if there's no interim? What if we just are still in session? What if there's no interim?
That scares me coming from the majority party.
What if there's no interim committee? What do we do with no interim committee if there is no
Chairman Butler, I mean, I'm sure you could provide Office of Rural Health with some, you know, verbal guidance if you'd like in that.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Well, there is no assured interim committee on revenue. Mm-hmm. Is my only problem.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that there's a proviso within the statute that says if there isn't interim committees that would still be provided to the interim leadership. So.
That's fine. As long as we get that on the record.
But what if there's no interim? That's what I'm concerned about.
Well,
I'm more concerned about that than I am committee. So. But the information from the Office of Rural Health would then come back and take a look at the overall health care and revenue impact of all of these tax credits, as well as the means testing.
That's right.
For the rural tax credits, which is something. These are all items that have come up, and we've ground away at them, and now we're basically grinding the axe to the point where we can make it sharp. The definition, as it relates to the definition within this act, as well as the definition of frontier county,
that's right,
with 19 or fewer population. And finally, the overall condition of medical, mental, nursing, and pharmaceutical services in rural and frontier counties, which needs to be returned and reported on, as well as all the credits and means testing. So I think, colleagues, that the Dash 7 accomplished what it is that we've been attempting to try and accomplish with this bill. I commend those members who have worked on this, as well as the other folks who have assisted from all aspects, including the Oregon Health and Sciences University and the Office of Rural Health. Questions of staff? Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, look at the definition of the change definition of frontier and rural only applies to EMTs, correct? Only applies to this one. It doesn't apply to those receiving benefits now under the Oregon.
Chairman Butler and Representative Boquist, that's correct. There was an earlier version that unfortunately had that applying. But this says, as you can see, line 22, as used in this section, meaning section 2, dealing with the EMTs, rural means, and then it gives that definition.
And the report then would cover this report on this definition of rural, but it would also expand it to talk about what happens in truly frontier counties as well. Not necessarily that this bill in and of itself affects those frontier counties, but as we're looking at means testing these credits and so forth, I think it's very important that we have an opportunity to have someone examine that with an eye towards what does the credit look like if you begin to offer it for those areas which are truly devoid of the medical services and services that are provided here, and what happens when you begin to study it and examine it under a microscope if it really is doing the service that we're trying to do. And that was one of the things that we've been concerned about, is to make sure that this credit is yielding us the kinds of results in those frontier and rural areas of the state. Further questions, comments, the committee? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the -7 amendments to House Bill 2787.
The motion is to pass the -7 amendment dated June 1st to House Bill 2787. Discussion? Is there any objection to the -7 being appended to 2787? Hearing and seeing none, Representative Comp is excused on other business of the House. We will order the -7 appended to 2787. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2787 as -7 amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
The motion is to move House Bill 2787 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Discussion of the motion. Representative Hass.
Thank you. I really admire the work done on this bill and the intent of it, but as I said yesterday on a similar bill, that we really have no method of prioritizing what we're doing when we hand out tax breaks, however well intentioned. And as we keep doing that without some sort of a system in place, we are, I think, pulling from this end at the expense of this end. And, for example, the expenditure on this is money that could go into the Oregon Health Plan with a 2-to-1 match and do more, twice as much for health care. And it's those kinds of conversations that never are held when we just keep adding on to our tax expenditure book, which looks a lot like a Spiegel catalog. And like Spiegel, I'm afraid that we may also go bankrupt if we don't turn that process around. So in spite of the good intentions and the good things that this bill could do, I'm going to vote no.
Thank you very much. Representative Hass has served intention to vote no. And Representative Hass, to your comments, if we look at Section 2, I think that begins to address some of your concerns. I'm sorry, Section 5. I share your concerns, but I'm anxious that this will be, passage of this bill will be a way where we'll begin to get that report and open that dialogue in the interim. So I'm anxious for that and appreciate the concurrence of the Office of Rural Health to come forward. No further discussion. We'll ask the clerk to call the roll. Motion is to pass 2787 to the floor of due pass recommendation with the -7 amendment.
Representative Oakley.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Alicio.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hess.
No.
And Chair Butler.
Butler votes yes, and we will excuse Representative Comp, and we will House Bill 2787 with the -7 having passed, having received the necessary yes votes, is declared passed to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Boquist, you've been working on this. Do you want to carry this, or do you want to go back to one of those other rural oriented folks? Okay, Representative Boquist will carry this. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2787. Any information on 896 amendments, Paul?
We just got them.
They just arrived?
Got them, but I think we have to copy them.
Okay, and we'll then we're waiting for the author of those amendments from...
He's got him, I guess.
Thank you. Someone sent word, someone said word next door. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 896. And colleagues, the -A3 amendments are just being handed out. And we'll... Lizbeth, will you take us through what 896 does first, and then we'll go from there?
Okay. Chairman Butler, the original bill that came out of the Senate with 896 was establishing a new employer tax credit for wages paid to employees who assist in the manufacture of a water transit vessel. And it defines what a water transit vessel is. It specifies that the tax credit is the lesser of $2,500 or 15% of the wages paid to employees during the tax year. It restricts the tax credit to just the tax liability of the taxpayer and clarifies that the wages included in the tax credit calculation cannot include wages from employees that the employer receives federal funds for on-the-job training. It also allows both a deduction and a credit for the employer and allows a non-resident or a part-year taxpayer to claim a prorated tax credit. It specifies that new employees cannot be former employees of the employer, and the employer's total full-time employees must be larger than in the prior year. It applies to persons initially hired on or after January 1st, 2006, and the tax credit begins on or after January 1st, 2006. So basically, this is, you know, wages of new employees, and these new employees have to be hired on or after January 1st, 2006. They can't lay people off and then turn around and rehire the exact same number. You have to have an increase in the total number of full-time employees over the prior year. Now, basically, you're trying to incentivize the manufacturer of these water transit vessels, and there's testimony and stuff about a particular ship and a builder that basically wants to build these water transit vessels. Under current law, you have a few of these, looking just at old employment department reports on the ship and boat building industries. There were 11 employers in that industry, and in 2002-03, the outlook was very small as far as the forecast between 2002 and 2012. It was only expected to grow 5.6%. So this act is basically trying to encourage this particular industry. So as far as the revenue impact, is small, minimal, less than $50,000 a year, and that's, you know, because I'm not assuming many people will actually take advantage of this, and really you've got a whole industry that's only projected to have less than 50 new employees hired between 2006 and 2012. And so basically, and you've got a pretty strong cap here of only $2,500 of the credit each year that can be used, because that would be the lesser or 15% of the wages paid to those employees. So that there's limitations on the credit as it came out of the Senate.
Okay. I guess I would ask a question.
Oh, here we doubled it. Went from 2,500 to 5,000. I see that in line 7 of the A3.
That's my prior amendment.
What's all this? What's this?
And then we've got new language here.
New language. We'll need to go through that language.
Yeah.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we, while we're waiting for the bill's author, why don't we stand at ease for...
That guy's there.
Okay. But do we have...
Senator Starr.
Yeah. Senator Starr. Why don't we just stand at ease until Senator Starr comes in? We'll just stand at record now. Come back on the record. Thank you very much. Excuse the brief absence from the record. Representative Starr, or Senator Starr, the A3 amendments have come forward now, and this would change the credit. It would exempt some... real property in excess of $1 million, real property improvements, and does some other things. We're assuming that you've had at least an opportunity to have some input on the amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Senator Bruce Starr. Mr. Chair, in conversations with the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee and others, we looked at this bill as it passed, really passed the Senate, and said, you know, this is a pretty modest effort to try to incent new business to Portland or to Oregon, and we decided to try to find a way to increase the incentive, and so that's why you see the bill as it's amended in front of you. I've worked with the chair of the Senate committee to ensure that when the bill comes back for concurrence, that the concurrence motion will be made on the Senate floor. Mr. Chair, I don't you have had the explanation of the amendment. I would just like to talk briefly about what we are trying to accomplish here, and Mr. Dan Yates is with me as well, that really is the expert on the issue. Portland, for a long time, has had a long history of shipbuilding, boat building, and it goes back for decades. And unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, we've lost that industry for the most part. We've got tremendous resources, however, primarily, as I look at it, on the Willamette River, facilities available that are just sitting idle. We also have, I think, a significant opportunity faced in front of us today and in front of our state. There is a growing demand for water transit, and it's not just the typical ferry that you maybe have ridden on in the Puget Sound, but we're talking about a special kind of ferry, and I'd like Mr. Yates to talk in more detail about that. Why do I care about this? I stood one morning on the banks of the Willamette River during rush hour traffic, and across the river you can see I-5, and I-5 is jam-packed. Cars not moving anywhere, trucks not moving anywhere, commerce is basically stopped in that congestion. Buses are also caught in that same congestion. In the same half an hour that I stood next to the river, one boat crossed in front of me on that river. We have a huge opportunity in capacity to move people, I think, on the Willamette River. And so I started thinking, well, who in Portland is the expert in moving people on the Willamette River? And I knew Dan Yates moves people, and he moves people primarily for entertainment. But I contacted Dan, and we started talking about the opportunity to really enter into a situation where you can have a significant impact on transit and moving people in and throughout the Portland area. That's the bottom line reason why this bill is in front of us today. I sought the experience of Dan Yates, and we brought this bill. This is about bringing new jobs, new opportunity, new business to Oregon. I think that there may be other places in the state that I'm not aware of that could take advantage of this, but this is, in my mind, primarily focused on the Portland area where we have facilities that are ready and willing, and available for this new business venture. The fiscal impact is minuscule. I don't expect, 100 of these manufacturers to come in, and 100 times 5,000 would be something. But I expect one, maybe two, would take advantage of this opportunity. The fiscal impact, too, on the $5,000 or the 15% of payroll, whichever is greater, is still only there when a manufacturer really makes a profit. I mean, until they start making money, that part of this bill really doesn't have any impact. And that's when my conversations with the Senate Revenue Chair, we had that conversation. He said, is this really enough of an incentive to bring folks that are going to make the investments that are necessary to come to Oregon? And in my conversations with the Senate Revenue Chair and with Mr. Warner and our revenue officer, he suggested that we look at the property tax side as a way to really impact the opportunity for folks that are going to invest millions of dollars, really, to come here, an opportunity to incent them to come.
You say some of these facilities are empty at present?
Yes, we do have, we basically have facilities, shipbuilding facilities that have been mothballed or are lying vacant. I think, Mr. Chair, at this point, I'd just like to turn it over to Mr. Yates, and he can briefly kind of explain a scenario and his experience with this particular issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Yates, president of American Waterways, Inc., operator of the Portland Spirit and her three sister vessels in Portland. Our vessels range in size from 40 to 540 passengers, and we conduct over 1,500 cruises annually. The United States has over 8,000 commercial passenger vessels carrying over 300 million people annually. Passenger vessel industry is comprised of dinner boats, charter boats, excursion vessels, water taxis, conventional ferries, fast ferries, and casinos. The fastest growing segment of our industry is the fast ferry segment. The United States has been very slow to adopt fast ferry technology due to regulatory and fiscal constraints. Due to our self-imposed structural constraints, we have fallen dramatically behind the Europeans and Asians. To close the gap, American shipyards have been licensing overseas designs and shipbuilding technology to build domestic fast ferries. Our domestic shipyards and operators are protected by the U.S. Coast Guard from inferior design and unproven materials, while the Jones Act, a federal law, ensures that all commercial vessels working in the domestic ports are constructed here, maintained here, and are manned by Americans. Only recently has our domestic market been allowed to take advantage of technical advances in ship design and new materials. The domestic ferry market is growing rapidly. It's grown from about 100 ferry operations in the 1980s to almost 500 companies today. About half the companies are public-private joint ventures, and the remaining half split between government-owned and privately owned. This growth has been spurred by technological advancements and traffic congestion. As a society, we're running out of places to build more roads, and yet our increasing population is demanding an ever-expanding rate of mobility. Ferries have become part of the solution to offering alternative transit options to expensive and inflexible rail systems and buses that are stuck in the same traffic jams that commuters are seeking to avoid. The water represents the last open right-of-way for governments to move people through. Historically, ferries have been restricted to slow speeds due to hull design and manufacturing limitations. Fast ferries, vessels that travel in excess of 35 knots, have rapidly gained acceptance because of their ability to overcome historical limitations. Fast ferries have been in use in Europe and Asia for the last 15 years and have dramatically improved in performance design and design. There are ferries going over 50 knots that carry over 100 vehicles and 1,000 people. The world has looked to fast ferries to cross wide bodies of water quickly and efficiently. In the last few years, the role of ferries has evolved with technology to work in restricted waters, like the Willamette. Creative hull designs, new propulsion systems, and new hull materials have created opportunities for companies like New York Waterways, a private company that carries over 100,000 people daily on 30 vessels in New York City. Their success at providing a speedy alternative is so successful that the Staten Island ferry system was forced to reduce its fare to no charge just to maintain ridership. San Francisco is looking at adding over 200 more fast ferries to their existing fleet of 35. In Seattle, a private company has just started passenger-only service on a fast ferry, and if successful, will add more vessels rapidly. The greatest challenge for ferry design has been wake reduction. In the past few years, design and new materials have overcome this great physical barrier, opening up many more opportunities for ferry operations. The opportunity to operate a fast ferry in the United States, it must be constructed in the U.S. The bulk of future sales in the fast ferry market will be restricted waterways like the Willamette River. The Portland region could need 30, 149 passenger vessels and a score of 49 passenger vessels alone to move people from Oregon City, like Oswego, to Portland and Portland to Vancouver. In the rest of the country, there is a potential market for several hundred new fast ferries. Presently, there are fewer than 10 shipbuilders capable of constructing fast ferries in the United States, and they have only the total capacity of building about 10 to 20 per year. Oregon has a proud shipbuilding history that is slowly disappearing. By providing a tax credit incentives for commercial water transit vessels, we may be able to revive this industry. The Passenger Vessel Association, the largest trade association for commercial vessel operators, has assisted in increasing T21 funding in the latest federal government transportation bill from $30 million annually to $75 million. The funding for ferries and their supporting infrastructure by the government as part of the mix of alternative transportation options has been growing quickly. This large increase, still a tiny percentage of the federal transportation budget, shows how ferries are gaining a foothold in providing crucial transportation improvements. In conclusion, Captain Gray sailed on the Columbia River over 200 years ago and started the modern age of shipping in Oregon. Kaiser Shipyard built hundreds of vessels in Oregon to support the World War II effort. Today, Gunderson and Zidell build world-class barges for operations on the Columbia River, Willamette River, and the Pacific Ocean. There is no reason we cannot add to that history and start building the next generation of fast ferries in Oregon. A shipyard in Seattle is building fast ferries for New York City, and a shipyard in Long Island is building fast ferries for the state of Alaska. There's no reason that ferries are not being built here. There are several locations that are available for immediate investment, including a 20-acre shutdown shipyard in Portland, Tongue Point in Astoria, and a huge facility in Swan Island is significantly underutilized. Any of these locations and others could potentially take advantage of this legislation and provide excellent jobs to an area in need. Our shipbuilding community is small, but with a little help, it could rebound and become an industry for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Yates. The bill does not provide that these vessels would be employed here in Oregon by any means. It just says let's take advantage of the empty facilities which we have for construction, try and put those back on the tax rolls, even with an exemption, an upper exemption of $1 million in real property. Now, the real property exemption is for property of a manufacturer that exceeds $1 million. So that would be property owned by the manufacturer then. And that would be for the real market value, and that would include both personal and real estate, wouldn't it?
That's our understanding.
Okay. And let's see, Lizbeth, the increase of the credit from $2,500 to $5,000?
Well, Chairman Butler, I don't remember. I'll have to go back and look at the spreadsheet as far as, you know, what was the maximum amount. But I don't think it's going to put it over $50,000 the first year. That's what your question is. I guess I would just like to clarify, though, you know, what property are we talking about? Just real property? Are you talking about personal property? It says property, but there's no definition of property in here.
And that's why I asked whether it's real and personal, and that was the comment.
My expectation would be real and personal.
Okay, and so then did you want this also exempt from, you know, if this is a corporation? Because it just says taxation here. I mean, I know you've testified this is property tax, but, you know, this could also be exempt from the corporate property factor. So, I mean,
I'd like to be clear. I'm not going to be building ships anywhere in the state of Oregon. I am here as a buyer of ships, and it galls me to no end that the last boat I built and purchased was out of Wisconsin and had to be shipped out here by truck. And the one before that was in Hawaii, and the one before that was New Orleans. So, you know, we are perfectly capable of building boats here. I've been talking to one shipbuilder who owns a 20-acre facility here in Portland that is closed. There is he built his last ferry there for the city of Tacoma about 8 years ago, and then he shut the yard down. I know that it's going to take millions of dollars of investment to bring it up to the point where it can produce boats again. I mean, it's just, you have to rebuild your machine shops, you've got to redo your ways, and he's going to have to obviously hire people. But he's interested. He had almost given up on the thought of ever reopening the yard again.
Yes, Representative Hass and then Representative Oakley.
Thanks. I have a couple of questions. I know there's an enterprise zone in North Portland and Swan Island area, and I think there's one in Astoria, too. Or you must be talking about these areas are not in those enterprise zones.
I haven't done that sort of research. But I do know that the Urban Renewal District, they're just talking about expanding it over into that the Swan Island area. It's actually right now on the west side of the river, or the east side of the river. No, west side.
I don't know the answer to that. You know, there's a potential that something along these lines could qualify for that kind of incentive as well. We haven't looked at that, quite honestly.
I just this passed the Senate, and then you amended the property tax exemption and doubled the amount. I was just curious as why.
Well, it was I sat down with the senator, the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee. He and I kind of put our heads together, and he basically said, you know, this isn't much of an incentive as the bill had passed the Senate. And he said, you know, why don't we look at increasing the incentive, make it more likely that somebody who's going to invest millions of dollars would take advantage of this opportunity. And so that's when I said, basically, I in some respects followed the direction of the Senate Revenue Chair and went and talked to Paul Warner and came up with this as something that would sweeten the pot a bit to incent somebody who's going to invest millions of dollars and put Oregonians back to work.
And the credit is only based upon, number one, their liability year by year. There's no carryover of the credit. And
right.
Number two, it's based upon jobs that are not presently in existence in
That's
the
correct.
State of Oregon.
It's pretty narrowly drafted. Even with doubling it from 2,500 to 5,000, it's still pretty narrowly drafted. And still on that piece of it, these folks are going to have to make a profit in order to take advantage of this. If they're going to take advantage of the credit, they got to be paying some sort of taxes.
I guess it would be much like a tax credit I talked to the former governor about at one time, he said, but wait a minute, what happens if you brought, I said, well, yeah, 1,000 jobs, if you can bring 1,000 jobs, and be worth it. He says, yeah, but what happens if it brought 10,000 jobs or 100,000? This could be a lot of money. And I'm saying, you know what, I'd love to have 10,000 or 100,000 jobs in Oregon. These are family wage jobs. Shipbuilding is not...
skilled labor.
Yeah, it is skilled labor. It is not low end. Representative Boquist, was that responsive, Representative Hess?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I have several questions, Mr. Chair, but I've actually been to Tongue Point. I think it's 4 or 5 miles out of Astoria, so I don't think it wouldn't be eligible for their enterprise fund. A couple of questions, and just a clarification. The first one, Senator, you may mention there's nobody that's eligible for this as of today. Is that correct?
That's our understanding, absolutely. And, Mr. Chair, if I could also add, we further clarified in the on the top of the amendment, the definition of water transit vessel, we more tightly defined that. And that was an issue that was raised both really in the Senate. We promised to address it in the House, and then also in the House Water Committee. That issue was brought up. So we wanted to
follow up. Well, and I think this is more of the expertise here. What's the draft of, I mean, you said a high-speed water transit vessel. What's the their draft compared to the normal draft of a barge or something like that?
Well, the vessel that I've spent about 6 years researching the potential of putting some sort of water transit system on the Willamette River, especially now that we're approaching building a billion-dollar bridge over the Columbia and we're running out of room to move people from south of Portland to downtown Portland. The vessel that intrigues me is called the Harley Craft. It is actually the designer who owns it, and he's presently building them under government contract from the military. Yeah, I know Oregonians are suspicious of the military. The whole concept was created to try and move freighters from the United States to the Middle East in under 2 weeks. So you can move a 1,000-foot ship at 80 miles an hour to the Persian Gulf so that you could reduce the transit time of war material. Well, his design, which he's built, I've ridden his 54-foot version, his prototype, and on the Tampa River, and we went at about 60 miles an hour, about 40 feet from two guys in a two-man rowboat that were fishing, and we didn't even ripple them. It was the boat only draws about 10 inches when it's operating. What it actually has is a blower in the bow that forces air underneath the boat, lifts it up, but not completely out of the water. The energy transfer required to lift it completely out is exponential. So he leaves about 10 inches, and he gets tremendous fuel economy by leaving that 10 inches. But the unintended consequence was virtually no wake. And so that has opened up a whole realm of these restricted waters. The other way of getting around it is long, thin aluminum boats, which is where most people are going right now. That's very proven technology. On the Willamette River, it doesn't really work because we have this thing called the steel bridge, which only has a clearance of about 20 feet, which is a railroad bridge. And you have to call Omaha, Nebraska to get permission to lift it, and it's 110 years old and highly unreliable. Anyway, on a hot day, it doesn't always open. So, you don't want
to. Other than that, it's a great community.
It is. It's a fabulous bridge because it does move a lot of rail. But it's not something that you want to be involved in part of your transit scheme, so you have to design a boat that can get underneath it and maintain a schedule. And so the Harley Craft satisfies the wake requirements. It satisfies the height requirements, but it has incredible speed. They're building an 80-foot version of it right now that is looking to be able to go 80 knots with 149 people on board. I don't propose going on. I'm not talking about the Willamette River transit system, but there are opportunities to use 80-knot boats in the San Francisco Bay, on the middle of the bay, once you get away from your dock, to reduce your transit time to 15, 20 minutes across the bay instead of driving an hour around it. There's lots of opportunity for that type of application.
For the question you're representing?
Yeah, I mean, what you're really talking about is kind of an airfoil design is what it sounds versus...
Well, it's called a surface effect
yeah.
ship, and it's...
It is true, and the reason that I raised that draft issue is, of course, in the legislature states with several other issues from policy committees and everything else in regards to dredging, and, you know, we've been unable to dredge the Columbia, which means we don't have the draft, so therefore, we don't have the draft there. We're talking about closing the Oregon City lock, some of the Corps of Engineers, and talking about stopping dredging from Newburgh Pool downward, and so I'm just trying to get a grasp here of, it's a great idea, Senator, but, you know, you can't, no matter what draft, you got to still have draft.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Can't go over rock bars. So.
That's right.
Okay, Representative Berger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Gentlemen, I think you got a great notion here, and seeing on the Revenue Committee, I'm sensing the fact that Oregon has a wonderful transportation manufacturing industry. It's what one of the things we do in Oregon, and I think you're right. We've lost it in terms of we've got all these docks that aren't doing this anymore. That being said, I'm a little bothered by the fact that this did not go through any economic development committees who really work on building, and you're going to speak to that in a minute, and I'll let you, because those are the committees that talk about enterprise zones and are strategic in trying to get an industry like this going, and so I want you to talk to that. And also, I don't really see any evidence here that this little, even with the $1 million, it is a little incentive, might actually bring someone, your friend that I would like to hear from you, Mr. Yates, your friend who said he'd be interested. Did he tell you why he quit in the early 90s? Because if it, whatever issues led to the demise of this industry in Oregon, it's sort of a more important question than whether this very small, and it is very small, incentive might actually get it revamped. So if you'd address those two things, I'd appreciate it.
Well, let me address the policy committee. It did originate in the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee.
Okay.
So we did have that discussion. And really it boiled down to the issue of we have the existing facility in mothballed shipbuilding facility, not just one but many. And this is a proper opportunity to attract and incent new investment, create high-paying, high-wage jobs. And so based on those three issues that were brought out in that committee, the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee stamped off on it, said, looks good, sounds good, and we sent it to Senate Revenue. And then on the House side of the Capitol, it went to water, which was interesting. I can take some blame for that, in that I didn't get over, you know, to talk to the Speaker's office maybe ahead of time to say this is really a business and economic development bill. But nonetheless, the Water Committee had a hearing on it. We talked to them, and they forwarded it to you. So that's kind of the route it's taken. It has had kind of that economic look, at least in the Senate side. And I'd let
for why the gentleman that owns this 20-acre yard is considering coming back. Shipbuilding tends to be a family business. The Nichols family actually built the last two commercial vessels in Oregon that I'm aware of. One was the ferry for Tacoma, which was built in the yard in Portland. Another Nichols actually built the Columbia Gorge paddle wheeler in the 80s in Hood River, and that yard has been closed since that vessel was purchased or constructed. Mm-hmm. Well, the Nichols family still exists, is in the fourth generation on Whitby Island, and have a very large yard on Whitby Island that is not really appreciated by their community, in that they have been placed tremendous restrictions and are allowed to work after 5 o'clock at night. Nobody wants the lights on in the yard because they're right in the middle of town, because that's the town kind of grew around them. He's not allowed to. He is restricted to only being able to build three boats at the same time. He is out of room. The yard went out of business in '96 because, being a family-run business, the next logical person to operate the Portland yard was his 26-year-old son, who Justin ran it into the ground. In a space of 2 years, he didn't know how to bid repair work, and the yard became financially just unsupportable. Justin now is 38, has been working under the guidance of his father, and is ready to take another shot at it. And his dad is also not ready to retire, and so he's keeping running the Whitby yard. But it is an opportunity to reopen up this yard that is sitting vacant. And he has to. He thinks his son now has the skill set and the experience to run it successfully. This has kind of brought it back to front of mind. It's kind of a marriage of opportunities. I don't see it as the only opportunity for shipbuilding in Oregon. I really do think that. I know Astoria has been focusing a tremendous amount of effort on its tourism, but I've never seen a community so invigorated with opportunity, and Tongue Point is an opportunity sitting there. And there are other communities on the Columbia River that I could see taking advantage of this potentially. Rainier has the last a little dry dock that is operating and still getting along, and they may be able to participate in something like this and grow their business. There's opportunity. And Cascade General, if they could ever figure out their labor issues, they might be able to turn it around. But I'm not pulling my breath on them.
Representative Boquist?
Thank you, Chair. Are there any, you mentioned Hood River had a former facility. Is that facility still there, closed down, or does Cascade Locks have a facility?
Cascade Locks does not have a facility, but they just have a little marina and a dock. Hood River, I believe, the ways are still there, but they've been taken over. One of our screwball industries in Oregon that no one has heard of is Maritime Services Corporation, which is the largest remodeler of cruise ships in the world. And they have offices in London, Miami, and Hood River, natural combination. But because every job is an away job, they literally ship teams of 20, 30, 40 Oregonians to Hong Kong and to mm-hmm. Singapore to work on these cruise ships. And they have the ways there because they would like to someday get back into building ships also. But I haven't talked to George. I hadn't even thought about talking to George Selfridge about this.
Thank you. Representative Riley?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly declare a potential conflict of interest here. Mm-hmm. I have a relative who's an unemployed ship welder.
Any ship welder is on it.
Representative Galizia.
Yes. Portland has been mentioned a lot. I wonder what kind of incentives the city of Portland offers now, and if you're aware of none, have you approached the city of Portland or Multnomah County?
Well, the city of Portland has the Portland Development Commission, which is really restricted to only working in its urban renewal districts. And the urban renewal districts only are comprised no more by statute 15% of the city. And as far as I know, the urban renewal districts don't extend into the working harbor part of where the mothballed shipyards are. They're more into developing neighborhoods. And the Portland Development Commission, if truth be known, is really a housing administration. It's not really a jobs creator. That's another argument.
There may be, through Multnomah County, some sort of enterprise zone that one of these may fall into. That's not, not an area that we've explored. In the event that this incentive gets put into place, perhaps, you could look at a package of incentives that could be put together. That's done by economic development agencies on a regular basis, and it could be done in this case as well.
That's certainly what we pay those folks for. They're already on staff.
Yep.
Other questions from these folks? So Representative or Senator Starr, the A3 amendment, so far as you can see, and which includes the applicable beginning time beginning in July 1st, 2006, and this in effect has its own sunset in it because it only applies for any company that would be using it no more than a total of 7 years.
That's the property tax exemption, would be a 7-year exemption.
Okay.
The other piece, I don't believe there's a sunset.
There is no sunset on the $5,000 at this point.
I just wanted to clarify. Did you want only to be able to take, you know, the exemption on the amount above $1 million, but just the amount that was claimed in 1 year? Because basically, if you say you made improvements of $1 million in 1 year, and then the next year you made another $1 million improvements, the way this is written, you only get from the first year, the exemption amount only grows by 103%. So if in one first year you made $1 million in improvement, and then the next year you made another $1 million in improvement, so then maybe you had $2 million in improvements, your exemption amount would not be $2 million in the second year, it would just be $1 million times 1.03. Is that what you intended?
It's not what I intended.
That's the way it's written in lines 19 and 20.
Looks like we may need some additional definition on line 16 as to property, which really is defined as the real and personal from the testimony here today, and then some work on 18, 19, 20, and 21 relative to the additions to real property, total of which would be the amounts of $1 million or more. Yes, Representative Berger?
And as long as we're amending, I would like the whole thing to have a seven-year life for review. If it works, great, if we can get somebody in. But by sunsetting it, we can at least see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess?
Thanks. I tend to think that it's easy for legislators to say this makes good sense. It won't cost the state anything if there are no new jobs. And my sense is that's why it came through the Senate as fast as it did. When you add the property tax exemption component, not only is there some complications, but to be so bold as to consider not putting that part in for now. I just throw that out, and we will have more success taking one smaller step than
your take on that, Representative, is that there may be urban renewal or enterprise zones.
Yeah, I think there might be. Plus, I think that in the effort to pass something and be successful, that it just might, what's the analogy, might be too much ballast for this.
In that vein, I would
we might get to it.
I would feel better if this exemption were more tightly defined, and I'm not sure what the language would be about, you know, new equipment brought in, for instance, for this industry, an exemption that actually says you bring in the equipment and we'll give you the exemption. But if you're just re-upping something that is sitting there, I'm less comfortable with that. I guess I want a more tight, I'd be more comfortable with a better definition of what exactly, if we're truly trying to encourage this industry, and they're going to have to bring in equipment.
Well, I agree. But I would think, seeing how there hasn't been a boat built in years, that everything has been fully depreciated anyway.
That's probably true, but it's probably also not useful equipment for modern boat breaking either.
Well, I don't see them having any other choice but bringing in things.
And I'm just asking that be more clearly defined in the statute, that is the case.
And
I agree that it is the case.
It isn't necessarily the depreciated market value as much as it is the real market value, which may have the buildings may have been depreciated to zero, but the real market value, particularly if they start crank back up, then they have a greater real market value in production. So I think that would require some additional definition. Senator Starr, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just asked, not being a tax language expert and how that all works. If Lizbeth, if you can work with Dexter and myself to get the appropriate language in the next draft of amendments. Mr. Chair.
We'll instruct staff to do that.
I'd be happy to make those changes and would, again, welcome the opportunity to have the bill come back in a work session.
Thank you very much, Senator, and we do appreciate you coming today and taking time out of your business schedule. And Mr. Yates, thank you very much, and thank you for what you do for business in Oregon. Colleagues, what we'll do is by notice of the chair today, Senate Bill 896 will also show up on tomorrow's schedule. So we are under a 24-hour notice, and we'll put that on by having it on the schedule today. The rules now provide that once a bill is noticed, if it has to be carried over, then it can be carried over from the same schedule from the prior day. So with that, while we will close today's public hearing on Senate Bill 896, we will also reschedule 896 for even time tomorrow. With that, colleagues, we will move on to Senate Bills 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. Let's see. Mazin, will you come forward on Senate Bill 21? We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 21. You've got 2 minutes, Mazin. That's 2 minutes total.
All right. Well, from floating ships to floating bonds.
Oh, my God.
Bond sink. The sinking fund.
Senate Bill 21, Mr. Chair, that we've talked about previously in the 17th. And in a nutshell, what it does, it deletes the prohibition on the investments in foreign securities for both types of investments that are done. One of them is for the state, and the other one for the investment pool, local investment pool, as in Section 2 of the bill.
So this now allows the funds that we can invest in to include some portion in the high-quality foreign investment markets, instrument market. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's okay. Correct.
Question of staff on the effect of Senate Bill 21. Again, this is a follow-up hearing from a previous public hearing. We are in work session. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, 21, the motion is to move Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion to the motion? Is there any objection? Representative Boquist,
yeah.
Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I still remain uncomfortable with this, but I will vote in favor of it.
Thank you very much.
The Deputy Director out there.
And so, Representative Representative Boquist, do you want to carry this?
Oh, you know, I'd be delighted to, in fact.
Okay.
They might not like it.
Well,
maybe you could hold it.
I think we would assign for Representative Olson. You can counsel with him.
Okay. There you go.
Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? The motion is to pass Senate Bill 21 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Hearing and seeing no objection, we will the chair orders 21 to the House with a due pass motion. And let's see, Representative, we're going to start at the far end. Representative Olson, will you carry this to the floor?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
We will close the work session on Senate Bill 21, open work session on Senate Bill 22. Mazin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 22 also comes from the State Treasurer, and in your packets today for both bills, you've received this colorful diagram that puts together the processes of investment. This was based on your request last time in investment 101 type of discussion request. Senate Bill 22 had a sizable number of discussions last time, and I brought my ORS book today and ready to go through all these discussions as we go. However, you said there is only 2 minutes, so I'll make it.
And you've used them. Summarize now.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Having said that, this bill does three major things. Two of them just basically allows the treasury to invest the funds for public employees' retirement and an industrial accident fund using and going through the investments of stock. Common stock. Now, it also what it does by deleting the subsection 2 of section 1 is it takes out, whether this is intended or not, it takes out the restrictions of having mutual funds as the instrument for investment for the deferred compensation fund. And what it leaves in the new subsection 2 is that only the those deferred compensation funds, when it comes to mutual funds, the officer who's the treasurer, state treasurer, would be the one who chooses after consulting with the council. So it basically opens that up by doing so. Into the different and all kinds of investments from different instruments. Now, having said that, of course, it just goes into, and that's why we had to bring all the different laws into this issue, but I will stop here unless you have.
Okay. The first is that it repeals the language which prohibits the direct investment in common stock funds with regard to certain of the asset or certain of the accounts that the treasurer manages.
Public employee retirement fund and the accident insurance fund.
All right. And the second thing the bill does.
The second thing, previously, as current law exists, allows deferred compensation fund to be invested only through mutual funds. This removes that restriction and allows it for a different.
So, can be a mutual fund.
Can be, or can be other instruments as well.
Other investment instruments. And the third thing it does, you said.
Those are the three things, Mr. Chair, but it allows here the...
Okay, so the first two things were safe and PERS funds, and the third thing then is that that they could be in mutual funds.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it allows... I'm sorry. The whole issue was to allow the treasurer to act as a manager of the investments altogether without having to go through intermediaries for buying the
funds. Could get a chair on the New York Stock Exchange if you wanted them.
And open, and that in the theory that it will save a great deal of money and it will not be new, but it will emulate a number of different states and different investment instruments for different states or different
other states do this already. Which thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Questions of staff? Representative Berger?
Yeah, Mazin, not just the treasurer, as I understand it, would also be state and local government to act as without an intermediary. Am I correct in that or wrong?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, actually, it is through the state treasury investment that the state and local government, and here where I would need to draw a whole web for you of how that works, actually.
It doesn't just authorize state and local government to just go out and buy on their own?
Not directly, no.
But through the treasury?
Through the money that they have with the treasury.
And it is the treasurer who manages all of those various accounts, so... In effect, the treasurer becomes the investment officer for all of those people.
Okay.
Other questions of staff? Representative Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest that the staff measure summary under what the bill does might need a little clarification, because as Representative Berger pointed out, and then Mr. Chair, when you and I met with reference to the Treasury Department, this whole phrase that allows state and local governments to take direct ownership position equities without contracting through outside fund management company
is slightly inaccurate or not clear. We may want to clear that up before it hits the floor. And as to the other one, I will support it for the rain of that row.
Mr. Chair, just to give you a little genesis on this, when we started on the Senate side discussing this was on January 31st, imagine 4 months ago to the day, we had 422 on 6205 from 1031. At that time, the staff measure summary, I went back to the records, and it was not including this language. However, after the testimony, the written testimony from the treasurer that specifies that language precisely, we thought we were wrong not to include it, but as it turns out, we were wrong to think that we were wrong.
Thank you for that explanation. That makes it clear as mud. Further questions of staff? Any comments from the members? We're in work session. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. One more quick question: Are we going to get a new staff measure summary with language that does not? That is the fundamental question that I haven't got an answer for yet.
Okay. I think this probably will. We need to clarify that it is not the state and local government that directly own, but through the investment that they have in the state treasurer.
Okay. And you'll provide that back to our offices?
Yes, as we put this through the process.
Excellent. Have an update. Representative Riley.
Well, what I just heard him say bothers me a little bit. The local governments do directly own this, which is they can't invest it on their own. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually the statutes very clearly prohibit local government from investing their funds in stocks. So they cannot own stocks in any companies.
But they can invest in the pool, which can own through the treasurer's office,
right,
the interest in common stocks.
Right.
Well, the short-term pool is also prohibited from having stocks. But there are some funds that allow through the PERS.
Which local governments actually have anything other than short-term funds?
They have the investment pool that they use at the beginning of floating bonds before they're done and so on. And then they would have the employer benefit trust. And then they do also, if we consider that the state owns or controls PERS and
for the employers.
Right, and the compensation or the deferred comps, those also are partly owned and controlled by local government as well.
And that's owned but not invested by local government.
Yes, it is invested by the state treasurer for the benefit of.
It doesn't allow the investment by the local investment officer. It allows the ownership through the treasurer. It's kind of a pass through, if you will.
Yeah. Because the local investment officer is precisely and very explicitly prohibited from owning common stock.
Investing in the
company. But this would change that.
No.
Okay. That's what I want to get clear on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you'll make sure that that's clarified on the new SMS, I would appreciate it.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions of staff? We're in a work session. Representative Berger?
Well, in that case, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 22 to the House floor with a blue pass recommendation.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 22 to the House floor with a blue pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there objection on that motion? Hearing and seeing none, we will order Senate Bill 22 to the House floor with a blue pass motion. We will move down to Representative Riley. Will you carry that?
Yes, sir. I'd be pleased to do
that. Excellent. Thank you. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 22, open the work session on Senate Bill 23.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 23 also we've looked at, and it has come to you as an A and gross version. And we, when we discussed it, we were looking at the whole compilation of language, and we had testimony to explain it almost section by section. Primarily, it just reorganizes sections in the ORSs and in different laws to allow the bonding authorities for local governments and so on, and it resolves different language with the debt limit about the bonds that were floated for the obligation for compensation fund, or retirement funds, and it clarifies the 5% and the 1% limit thing on it. This also discusses on how the rule-making authority and for the Debt Management Advisory Council. It cleans up also an issue for a county with the idea of when floating of the bonds and on the part of the tax bill or the tax rate of when do they be able to recover that or send that in their bill, whether it's the fiscal year or it's in November, and how they could do that. So it puts and tries to fix up a whole bunch of issues altogether.
The Band-Aid is what I...
you remember this is the Band-Aid thing, right? And I remember Representative Berger saying, if this is the Band-Aid, then show me the operation or something. But, you also have in front of you an A2 amendment, and that puts... Right.
As the emergency clause. And the reason for the emergency?
The reason for the emergency, I guess, because it they need to get those fixed, and I think it just has to do with also the levying for the county that they are trying to take care of, that county's bonding authority and putting it into the rate, in addition to all the other issues that seem to have a very urgent type of timeline.
Okay, questions of staff? And I found the Preston Gates Ellis four-page handout very, very helpful in going through each of the sections of this revisers bill. There's a slight error on page 4, but it just has got some sections misnumbered. Other than that, I think everything else is in order. Further questions of staff relative to Senate Bill 32A and the proffered A2 amendment with the emergency clause on it today? Any questions for Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendment to Senate Bill 23.
The motion is to append the A2 amendment dated 6205 to Senate Bill 23 as previously A engrossed. Any discussion to the amendment or to the motion to amend? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered, we will append the A2 amendment to the 23A engrossed. Senator or Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 23 as A2 engrossed just a moment ago to the House floor with a due path recommendation.
The motion is to move the 23 as A engrossed with the A2 amendment appended thereto with the emergency clause to the House floor with a due path recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing no objection and recognizing the full complement of the committee, We will order that bill to the House floor as amended today, and it be engrossed. Let's see. We're down to move in one, Representative Galizio. Okay,
Representative Mazin's going to be there to help me out.
Yep.
Maybe the representative from Wilsonville will be absent that day and won't ask any questions.
We may want to prime him that day. Can somebody put some extra jolt in his coffee? That'd be wonderful. That'd be great. I'd love to see that.
Mr. Chair, I was going to try to help you out. This is all technical stuff. I don't know how any of us are
going to explain
this. I got that. It's the Band-Aid.
Yeah, okay. Representative Galizio will carry 23A to the floor, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 23A. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 24 and invite Steve. There was an amendment proposed, but that did not come to fruition.
I have not seen an amendment, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 24 deals with the Common School Fund, income to the fund. Current law talks about different kinds of income, whether it's interest, profits, dividend. And what the bill does was to eliminate specific references to types of income and just reference income derived from the investments of the Common School Fund. So that's the first change. The second change is to eliminate language that requires losses from investments and the sale of equity investments to be deducted from the distributable income account and credited to the Common School Fund. So that would, by not having to deduct those losses, then potentially there would be additional income that could be distributed. And it kind of separates the distribution policy from investment policy by not having to take those losses or to subtract those losses if they should be taken.
Okay. Colleagues, I'd ask for some kind of a worksheet to kind of demonstrate how that flows. Has that been passed out to all members of the committee? Okay.
I have not seen it.
Do we have extra copies of it by any chance? We just go ahead and get those to staff, please, and we'll get that passed out. This is just kind of a worksheet that talks about the second portion of what Steve just referred to and the realized and unrealized losses and allows for a cleaner definition. Thank you very much. A cleaner definition for the distribution out of the fund. I'll let you each have an opportunity to get one of those.
Yes, like shipbuilding.
Yes, cleaner shipbuilding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Trade.
Okay. There's examples of what happens when the fund has a realized gain and realized loss. And then these unrealized gains or losses that basically clean it up, which is a more standard for the industry, is my understanding. That's the testimony that was previously given to us. It's more standard for the industry. It presently, the statute does not allow these kinds of nettings with the gains and losses with unrealized. In effect, you get. Unfortunately, it's just been a problem in the past that hadn't gotten cleaned up previously. Other questions of members of the committee? Representative Escobar, you better study that over. As I look up and down, you're the next one.
Wait a minute, I have an appointment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 24 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The
motion is to move 24 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Berger.
I'd be delighted to carry this one.
No, really.
I think I have a carrier down here. With that... is there any objection to the motion to move this to the House for the due pass recommendation? Seeing and hearing no objection and recognizing Representative Hass is excused for other business of the House, the motion carries, and Representative Escobar will carry that to the House floor. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 24. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 25. and come back to Mary or Elizabeth.
No, so, Opus is next. Opus already has one?
We'll mail him very shortly. Elizabeth, please.
Chairman Butler, we've heard this bill before. This is another one of Treasury's bills, and this is dealing with the College Savings Network. So it's allowing the Treasury Department the ability to accept donations for awarding scholarships and grants and other incentives to account owners and their beneficiaries in the in the College Savings Network. It allows the Treasury Department the ability to encourage participation in awarding these grants and scholarships and providing other incentives to account owners and their beneficiaries or enter into promotional arrangements. And it's going to amend then 348-856 by specifying that all monies credited to the Oregon 529 College Savings Network Fund are continuously appropriated to the Oregon College Savings Board, and then it specifies the sources of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network Fund to include then these grants, these gifts, and these donations made to the state of Oregon for this purpose. And then it clarifies that the board can then use this money in the fund to pay administrative costs and expenses of the board and the College Savings Network to provide those scholarships or grants to account owners and potential account owners and their beneficiaries. It excludes the Oregon College Savings Network and the board from public contracting law, and then it applies to public contracts entered into on or after the effective date of this 2005 Act. It does have an emergency clause to this Act, so it takes effect March 1st, 2005. So basically, this is trying to increase participation in the College Savings Program, and this increase in participation in the College Savings Program would then lead to additional increases in the Oregon tax subtraction, which would reduce personal income taxes to the state, but the overall revenue impact is minimal, and it's pretty hard to identify because we're not sure how many new people would come in without these incentives.
Thank you very much. Questions of staff? We've heard this and had opportunities, I think, one and all probably, to visit with members of the Treasury staff regarding the funds and the proposal to move forward. Any questions of staff, questions, comments amongst the members? Representative Comp now moves Senate Bill 25 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion for the motion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing Representative Hass is excused, we will move Senate Bill 25 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. And we will ask Representative Comp, if you will carry that. That's a great bill for you. That is a wonderful bill for you.
That's a great bill for
you. It really is.
Representative Oquist, did you...
Of course, Mr. Chair, passed 26-0. Should it be on the consent calendar?
I think Representative...
I would really like
really
to
Representative
this
Comp...
you don't want to trade the Band-Aid bill? More interesting.
With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 25. There's no trading of players here. Colleagues, we have Senate Bill 283. There are amendments to 283, and that's not going to give us enough time to work it today. By order of the chair and by authority of the speaker and leadership of the House, we're going to move Senate Bill 283 forward to tomorrow's schedule. And we will post that now on tomorrow's schedule together with the carryover of 896, Senate Bill 896 carried over. So with that, colleagues, we're due back in the House in 4 minutes on the House floor. We will carry over 896 and 283 on top of tomorrow's already posted schedule. With that, we will close House Revenue for today.